Campus FM presents the first part of Chesterton as a Journalist, a conference organised by the University of Malta and Seton Hall University. This event was dedicated to the memory of John McAuliffe, alias Roma. Professor Peter Vassallo introduces the conference.
I'm very pleased to see such a large turnout for this Chesterton conference. It's the first of its kind in Malta. Warm welcome to our distinguished guests and to President Emeritus Seneca Dami, the Bishop of Gozo, Monsignor Gregg, and Mrs. Gonzi, and all of you, distinguished guests. Otherwise, I think I'd never finish. On behalf of the English Department, Department of English at the University, and the Faculty of Arts, it is my pleasure and indeed an honour to extend a warm welcome to our speakers from the United States in the first ever Chesterton Conference on the theme of Chesterton as a Journalist. Father Ian Boyd and Professor Dermot Quinn are distinguished Chesterton scholars from Seton Hall, New Jersey, and they will give us the benefit of their deep knowledge of Chesterton later this evening. The programme will also include a brief talk by Dr. Klaus Vellebardon on the genesis of the conference, another talk by Gloria Garofoli-Grabois on the Chesterton Review, a tribute to John McAuliffe by Ms. Monica Wiedersen, as John McAuliffe, as you probably all know, was, for the past two decades at least, was at Roma in the Sunday Times. He was a close friend, and I have to say this, and a wonderful man who sadly passed away earlier this year, and who was instrumental in the organisation of this important event. Alas, he died before he could be here. But I think his spirit is also here, and you will notice the poster there, which is prepared by Susan Vellebardon, very cleverly, and you can see John is seems to be peeping over and listening in to what Chesterton is saying. His spirit is there. And this will be followed by papers, of course, on Chesterton, by our main speakers, Father Boyd and Professor Quinn. The event is being sponsored by the Strickland Foundation, and I'm grateful, and by Farsons, Mr. Brian Jair in particular, to whom I'd like to record our gratitude. And now for a few observations on Chesterton as a writer, by way of introducing the subject. I call it usually a kind of hors d'oeuvre. The Folio Society edition of Chesterton's poems presents a delightful caricature of a portly G.K. Chesterton working a loose overcoat and a fedora, spectacles and a drooping moustache, holding a lit cigar in his right hand and transfixing with his cane in his left hand in a fencer's posture, loose leaves of controversy floating his way. This caricature by John Lawrence cleverly captures a significant aspect of the great man himself, always zestful in dealing with controversy, in duelling, I should say, with controversy, and speaking up for the rights of the common man, whose voice at the dawn of the 20th century was muted or unheard, and whose spirit was crushed by dreary, repetitive drudgery of work in factories. Most members of the audience will recall their first childhood encounter with Chesterton. I'm sure you all do. His delightful The Donkey, that tattered outlaw of the earth, who in spite of his ungainly appearance had one glorious moment, one fierce hour and sweet, or the rollicking Lepanto, with its rousing blaring of trumpets, its thumping of drums, and the flashing of banners celebrating that memorable triumph of Christendom against the formidable force of its Ottoman might. Back in 1571, when the last knights of Europe were aroused from the comatose lethargy. Interestingly, the poem was written at the time of his conversion to Catholicism, and it may suggest the panache and the crusading zeal of the neophyte. And of course, the rolling English road, rambling round the shire, as expressive of the good-natured, beer-drinking English, or Englishman, in Arcadia, Arcadian, country folk, as they relished the simple pleasures of life before they go to paradise by way of Kensal Green. Chesterton was a prolific and versatile writer, and most of his writings, infused with sparks of good humour and scintillating wit, established him as a defender of the romance of orthodoxy and the Christian faith at a time when in late Victorian and early Edwardian England, paganism had become an attractive alternative to religion. Many Victorians had turned to the Renaissance paganism, as you will know, and of course certainly know, and had become this attractive alternative to religion. And remember, Swinburne, in the poem Dolores, Swinburne's great poem Dolores, sort of pooh-poohed the idea of God and the rest of it. It was a kind of transgressive poem, transgressive agnosticism. And Ernest Dowson in Cynara, I did love you, Cynara, in my fashion, if you remember, and had set the modish tone of languorous decadence. One recalls here Chesterton's brilliant parody of Swinburne's poem, in which he makes Dolores, who represents Swinburnian agnosticism, reply to Swinburne using the same meter and rhythm. This is a brilliant parody. I think it's one of the most brilliant parodies I've read in my life, and I've read quite a few. Chesterton's novel, The Man Who Was Thursday, 1908, dazzles the reader with its flashes of Chestertone and paradox, almost on every page, and centres on the baffling theme of suffering and misery in the world. It was written 8 years before the horrors of the Battle of the Somme, and it is refreshing in its plea for valour, fair play, and the ultimate triumph of decency. The book's target is moral relativism and the popularization of the Nietzschean notion that right and wrong are mere cultural conventions. Such free-thinking philosophers, the novel argues, are dangerous because they undermine the very notion of law and order and irresponsibly open the floodgates of antinomianism. His delightful Father Brown's detective adventures extol the triumph of innocence over villainy. Father Brown, with his cherubic face, innocent aspect, glasses, and huge umbrella, quietly reveals his uncanny understanding of the workings of the criminal mind, which he finds himself confronting. Chesterton's versatility is impressive. He wrote poetry, nonsense verse, The Road to Roundabout is a clever one. His ballads, I'm very fond of, my favourite really is Old Noah in his Ark. Old Noah, who in the Ark sat with his wife to dine and didn't care where the water went so long as it didn't get into the wine. His literary criticism includes exquisite essays on Chaucer, Charles Dickens, Robert Louis Stevenson, and an appreciative, penetrating biography of St. Francis of Assisi, who was so gentle with brother Wolf, Fratello Lupo, but was so harsh with his brother the ass, Fratello Asino, his body. His output was considerable, and he was preeminently a controversialist and a brilliant satirist of anti-Catholicism, as Ian Kerr demonstrates in his recent splendid full-length biography, it's about 780 pages, which I should like to recommend to you for summer reason, for summer reading, perhaps. On that note, I will now pass on the baton, as it were, to my colleague, Klaus, yes. Colleague in the sense that we organized it, but he did most of the organizing. So really, he has done a lot of work behind the scenes. So Klaus, will you go on?
Thank you, Professor Vassallo. We are privileged to have you here. And for me, this conference is a dream come true. As I'm not a seasoned public speaker, I have to look at the notes quite often. And for me, it's a dream come true for two main reasons. Firstly, it's an opportunity to arouse interest in Chesterton. And secondly, this conference is also a tribute to my late friend, John McAuliffe, who wrote under the pen name Romer. And like Chesterton, was a journalist for some 40-odd years. Almost 4 years ago, he had written, "Rediscovering Chesterton has been one of my greatest delights." and so much so that he did his utmost to share this passion with his readers. And this is a passion that I shared with him, although I cannot compare to any extent my knowledge of Chesterton with his. I would consider him one of the most knowledgeable on Chesterton we ever had in Malta. However, I had one advantage over John. My interest in the writings of Chesterton was further fortified by the late Jesuit, Father Anthony Sapienza, a first-rate librarian, who introduced me to the outstanding journal, The Chesterton Review. And John was only too pleased to get hooked to this excellent journal, which was described by John Wren Lewis, a mathematical physicist of the University of Sydney, Australia, and MIT, USA, as a far more important journal than its name might suggest to the undiscerning eye, fostering not just the enormously wide-ranging and discerning work of Chesterton himself, but the whole tradition of social, socio-economic, ecological, historical, philosophical, and theological critique which Chesterton exemplified. With our shared enthusiasm of Chesterton, I tried to tempt John to join me in attending one of the conferences that the Chesterton Review organizes in Europe. But as his close friends know, John was never crazy about traveling overseas. So you can imagine his elation when almost a year ago, last June, Gloria, Gigi, I will say, for short, suggested that Father Boyd is interested in coming to Malta. I couldn't believe it. So anyway, John got in touch with Gloria immediately and threw himself heart and soul into getting this conference off the ground. Sadly, more evidently than most of us, John was living on borrowed time, as he was fighting liver cancer since the late 2010. The heroic surgery and medical treatment in UK gave him a new lease of life. But John cautioned me that it was unlikely he would make it till Christmas this year. And I dismissed it as his customary pessimism about medical matters. Unfortunately, he proved me wrong. And his death on the 3rd January shocked me profoundly, especially as I meant to go and see him that very day. John was instrumental in getting this conference going, and his sudden death, besides a great loss of a great friend, meant for me the end of the conference. But if John, as a true Chestertonian, was totally impractical on mundane matters, as his very close friends can testify, he was a man of faith and a firm believer in Providence. On being told of John's death, Gloria immediately came back to me to assure me that the Chesterton Review would dedicate the conference as a tribute to John. And from then on, Providence went into overdrive. His very close friends Brian Gerard and Peter Vassallo upheld their commitment to John as regards sponsorship and support of the English faculty respectively. And as Chesterton said, thanks are the highest form of thought, and the test of all happiness is gratitude. Well, all I can say is that I'm immensely grateful for having known John, and through him his amazing friends, as well as all those who helped me enormously. Listing people who helped me so disinterestedly and enthusiastically include the main sponsors, Farsons, the Strickland Foundations, as well as Exergy, Trisha Camilleri, who smoothed in the commitment of the university and worked hard to get the organization here, Tessa Bellucci, who ferreted out even articles to the press in 1934 when Chesterton visited Malta, the team of Discern, Father Joe Inguanis, Rebecca, and other members who worked a whole morning to send some 400 press invitations, and then people who publicized the event, like Monsignor John Charlov, Lehenis Sowa, Ray Bujay and Joe Greco of The Times, Mari Benoit and Erika Brinkat of The Malta Independent, Cynthia Zaraf of RTK, etc., 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 as the King and I would say, and so many other people. However, I must single out Adrian Porter, an IT specialist and a keen Chestertonian, who turned up as a dental patient because he was interested in, not in my dentistry, but in Chesterton. Thanks to his intense admiration for Chesterton and Romer, the time and energy Adrian dedicated to this conference was truly breathtaking. He would have loved to meet Romer, but it was not to be, as John died 3 days after I met Adrian for the first time. Along with Prof. Vassallo, he was indispensable in the organizing committee in making this conference a reality. But last but not least, I must also thank my dear wife, Susan, for putting up with me and encouraging me, especially through my phases of despondency. Thank you very much.
And now our next speaker is Ms. Monica Wiedersen, who will be paying a tribute to John McAuliffe.
When someone dies, you sit in a room and there are no sounds left. You look at a desk with a computer, and the chair behind it has gone very empty and very still and very cold. There's no one left. When someone dies, it is not only he that is gone, but so many other things with him. It is as if the ground that you walked on for so many years suddenly disappears. All the familiar everyday things that you trod on and never noticed too much are suddenly no longer there, and you try to walk over a big, dark, gaping hole instead. I think life is not so much about ourselves, but more about what we do to others, like we are told in almost every word of the Gospel. We are important only for the amount we leave behind to others, the good, the kind, the caring things we leave behind to them to fill their hearts with. These things never get forgotten, and they get passed on from generation to generation. John left an unfathomable amount of good behind, not only to those he loved, but to all of Malta. I think that we all know this by now. John was a very unique, intelligent, kind, and intellectual person, but above all, he was a man of God, and thus he was very highly principled. He was a silent man with so many words inside him, which, I think a bit sadly for himself, only truly came out with that wonderful pen of his. Malta benefited the most out of that. All of his caring came out in that pen for her, for Malta. And for almost 40 years, he did his best to save her from all that was harmful to her, politically and even more so morally. He tried to hinder every path that he believed would harm her. I think now everyone has realized that too. I sometimes saw the loneliness he felt when, in spite of all the efforts he made every single week, people derided his thoughts on religion. And in a supreme effort to have one good friend, a journalist of greater caliber to back him and stand up for him, he turned to G.K. Chesterton week after week, quoting his writings, which stated over and over again that the laws of God were the only reliable ones for man to follow for his own good. In the past few years, John became more and more concentrated on his readings of Chesterton. I often said I thought it was becoming too much. I realize, though, now even more so, while searching for things to say to you today, that in fact, John had found a new soulmate. I was, for John, a kind of soulmate. We talked of love and hate, war and peace, friends and foes, games of bridge, food and drink, my lack of punctuality and my strange ways, his fear of flying and his strange ways. We discussed and argued and even quarreled, but we valued and loved each other greatly. As I said, he was my only soulmate. But when he died, and I looked for days at his empty desk and could not find him anymore, my desperate glance went round and round his many books. I suddenly recognized that here was his real treasure hunt for thought. He used me daily as his punching ball, but this was his real boxing rink. We all in our way search for something precious to bring into our lives. For John, his search for that something precious, that treasure, was only truly achievable in the many books of all kinds that he delved into daily. He was right to do so, because in that way he came into daily contact with philosophers, theologians, politicians, idealists, fanatics, writers, dictators, revolutionaries, poets, painters, artists, kings and queens, emperors and fallen empires, popes, saints, sinners, and every kind of human that existed, but one God. In that wonderful study of his, which I shall never see again, I often felt as if I was entering a room full of persons which only he knew so very well, persons he had shared his thoughts with and gone into mental discussion and arguments with, persons he loved being with, persons he was fascinated with. Time and place played no part. Some of those persons lived centuries apart and had nothing in common with each other. And yet in John's room, they were all there in harmony, like a great gathering of party of acquaintances and friends. I have never been in a more packed room of interesting guys. Actually, I always think that heaven must be something like that, a place where so many wonderful beings will be gathered in some extraordinary unity with God, and where we can all see what God saw in us when he created each one of us as unrepeatable and unique beings. For of course, in his great love for us, he sees something very special lurking there beneath all our worldly camouflage. I have digressed just to say that in that room full of John's acquaintances, G.K. Chesterton must have clumsily bustled in one day. And big and wonderful as he was, he must have toppled over many things. But amongst them, most importantly, was John's searching mind. They must have met just like that, almost by accident, like he did with me. But this person was in a book, and he was therefore able to read every thought, every sentiment that went through his newfound friend. And I think he became his soulmate. They both wanted to transmit their God to the world outside, and that is what John started to do and is carrying on doing today. This conference taking place today is a fruit of his newly found friendship. It is a true tragedy that he is not here to open it today, as he managed to organize it all somehow. It must have been very difficult, as he was not very good at organizing things, even the smallest of things. He was quite stupid like that. When G.K.C. fell in love with Frances, was to be his wife, he wrote her a short note. "You are very stupid. You don't know how very nice you are." I similarly often used to tell John, "You are too intelligent and you read too many intelligent books to realize how very stupid you are." So, a little miracle that we are here today, as he left this planet exactly 18 weeks before this was due to happen. And it certainly wouldn't have happened had he had a clue about that. When someone dies, you often wonder about God. When I first met John, I was wondering about God. I had just lost my husband and I was only 31. And the whole of our relationship was based on those first conversations, because he was the only one who was capable of helping me in my desperate search for that love I believed God had for me, but which did not seem apparent. He never relied on his words as a person, but on those of God, and he offered me Ecclesiastes to read. Everything, you know the one, I imagine, it goes, "Everything that happens in this world happens at the time God chooses, a time for being born, a time for dying, a time for sorrow, and a time for joy, a time for loving, and a time for not loving." It healed me, and I have been delving into the Bible ever since. Well, when John died, after a whole year of my trying everything to make him live, I wondered yet again about God. I went back to Ecclesiastes. A time for what? What was that year all about? It is now clear to me that God planned it purposely this way. He knew that no matter what John wrote and did, he would only achieve everything that he had tried so hard to do for God by his suffering and dying. We all know that God is an expert in such matters. His only son had to suffer and die. He let John suffer the one thing he was truly so scared of, cancer. So it was definitely the ultimate suffering for him to have. He was so scared of it that he was even afraid to have his eyes tested at the oculist, as he had heard or read somewhere that they can discover cancer through peering through your eyes. On the evening he was told that he had cancer, He looked at me and he asked, "Was I brave enough?" He was always scared that he would go to pieces about it. He lay there close to dying for a whole week, and nothing was done or could be done, it seemed. But God sent a man, an angel from God. He is not sitting here today. I would have hoped he would be. But I know he was sent from God, for he told me what to do to save him and where to go, what surgeon might be prepared to go into one of the rarest cases of cancer. It was the first miracle, and John got onto that plane somehow, with no passport somehow, and with about 24 hours to live. He was saved. The second miracle was his 8-hour operation, which, had he not been strong enough after a month of slow recovery, could never have taken place in time. He made it to the day, and he came out of it alive. The surgeon, no doubt, was another angel, as all his consultants had advised him to drop the case, and he just wanted to save John because he found him to be a great guy. His remarks to me at the end of the operation were, "I have never had a more perfect operation." John got better and better, more good-looking even. And then suddenly, after Christmas, just 1 year later, the cancer hit back, viciously this time. I couldn't believe it. A time for what? After all that happened, though, after John's death, I got my answers. When people first heard John had cancer, they started to care about his dying. I received so many letters for him. The editor, Stephen Malia, was wonderful, and he waited for John to come back week in, week out, to continue on his column. Everyone realized suddenly that he was important to the nation. Everyone watched and waited. Had he died that first week, none of that anxiety would have taken place. He was welcomed back, and he saw suddenly for the first time that he was needed and wanted. I suppose it must have been a great relief to him. So he went back to his desk and wrote and wrote and wrote again, to his almost last breath. I helped him stagger down on that last Saturday morning and watched him write as he wriggled around in pain on his chair. And then he stopped and said, "I have to stop. I can't manage the last 300 words. And so Roma ended, 300 words short. He went into hospital that night to start dying. But God had made him known to all and missed by all, and so he will remain in history. I came here to tell this tale as a tribute to John, because I have also loved him for a very long time. I was terrified to come up here ever since Klaus asked me if I would do it. He is now dying for me to get off this podium. But before I do, I would like to thank all those who recognized and acknowledged John, the Honorable Dr. Fenech Adami, for the eulogy he made for John at the presentation of the Gold Award for Journalism. I was unable to hear it, but I would like to thank him for John. I would like to thank Bishop Mario Grech for leaving Gozo and other appointments to come here to this conference as an honor to John. He was also the one to send words of comfort and prayers at the time of John's operation, and a picture, which I managed to get in my iPhone, of Madonna Tapinu. In fact, John's first words when he came out of the operation were, "Madonna Tapinu." So I think he must have seen her. I would like to say publicly to Bishop Grech how much John admired your courage and fortitude. I think you should always continue the way you are. I also want to thank Professor Albert Fenech, who is unfortunately not here, but he did so much to save John and helped him right to the very, very end. I end now with a very short poem, which John read to me. It was written by Chesterton to his wife, Frances, who he loved very much. I don't know whether he was using those words to tell me something, but I am offering them back to John as I get a feeling he can hear me now. To my love, God made you very carefully. He set apart a star for it. He stained it green and gold with fields and aureoled it with sunshine. He peopled it with kings, peoples, republics, and so he made you very, very carefully. All nature is God's book, and it is filled with his rough sketches of you. Thank you.
And now we have to go on to Gloria. Gloria, I think it's Garafuli Grabois, but for short, GG. I think this makes sense. And she will be speaking about the Chesterton Review.
Just a very few words. John used to call me Gloria GG, so I guess in Malta I will be known as such from now on. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, Eslim Alikom. Sorry, my Maltese is not very good. On behalf of the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture at Seton Hall University, I would like to welcome you to this first Chestertonian evening in Malta and to thank you for being here today at a conference which is a tribute to two great journalists, G.K. Chesterton and John Micallef, a.k.a. Romer. The G.K. Chesterton Institute was founded in 1974 by Father Ian Boyd. It is a non-for-profit educational organization based at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. It is incorporated in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Its purpose is to promote the thought of G.K. Chesterton and his circle and to explore the application of his ideas in the contemporary world. The Chesterton Review is a journal of the Chesterton Institute. The review has been widely praised for both its scholarship and the quality of its writing. It was founded in 1974 to promote interest in all aspects of Chesterton life, work, art, and ideas, including his Christian apologetics. The review is published in English, and it has an annual edition in Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Italian. It is through the friendship of longtime subscribers to the Chesterton Review that we are here today, Klaus Vela-Barden and John Micallef, who, as we're paying tribute to him, we sadly know that he has left us a couple of months ago. Although I never had the pleasure of meeting John personally, during the first organization stages, over many phone calls and emails, I got to know him a little. He was a great and dedicated Chestertonian, journalist, a gentleman, and a gentle man. He is not with us today, but his presence and his spirit is felt here nonetheless. I believe that John is smiling upon us today. When Klaus approached us about having a Chesterton conference in Malta, Father Boyd immediately said yes, and Klaus, John, and I started planning. A few months ago, when John died, while still in shock, we spoke again, and it was with great determination that we went ahead with the organization of this conference as a tribute to him. We would like to express our deep appreciation to our co-sponsors, whose support has been essential for this conference, Mr. Brian Guerra of the Farsons Group, the Strickland Foundation, the University of Malta, to Adrian Porter, Professor Vassallo, Klaus, Susan, and everyone who has in any way have taken part in organizing this event. A very special thank you to Klaus, whose enthusiasm and hard work bear fruit today. Thank you. Grazie, Hafna.
And now we move on to our first sort of our main speaker, one of the main speakers, our two main speakers, and it's Professor Dermot Quinn, who is Professor of History at Seton Hall University, and he's a member of the Board of Advisors for the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture, and a member of the editorial board of the Chesterton Review. He has written extensively on Chesterton themes, and I must say as well that he was a graduate of Trinity College Dublin and New College Oxford, and therefore a fellow Oxonian. And it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Dermot Quinn. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor, and thank you all so very much for coming out this evening. When Professor Vassallo was giving his opening remarks, he spoke of Chesterton's panache and crusading zeal, and I rather thought that Professor was describing himself as well as Chesterton. Professor Vassallo's erudition and wit are famous in Malta, and indeed throughout the English-speaking literary world, a combination of erudition and wit, which can only be due to the fact that he too is a graduate of New College Oxford, not simply an Oxonian, but a graduate of New College. I have often come to places and have begun my remarks by saying that it is a pleasure to be where I am. But in a particular way, it is a privilege to be in Malta. I have known Malta, or known of Malta, all my life. When I was a teenage member of the Knights of Malta, the St. John's Ambulance Corps, where I was a singularly ineffective person helping people into ambulances, as a bookworm, I was able to tell people, give them a theory of what was wrong with them, but I wasn't actually able to put any bandages on them. So I've known Malta since I was a teenager. I have obviously, as the world knows Malta, known it as twice besieged and twice unconquered, and that is the Malta that the world admires, a heroism which has been honored by English kings and Roman popes. And in a particular way, I am honored this evening to be at a conference to acknowledge Malta's greatest Chestertonian, and that is John. Chesterton once said that the role of the journalist is to tell the public that Jones is dead when the public hadn't even known that Jones was alive. I think everybody knew that John was alive, and John is alive today in all our hearts. I never knew John. I had looked forward so much to meeting John, and as our conference was being put together, I followed John's progress and, alas, his decline. So it was a kind of long-distance grief for all of us to know that John could not be here this evening. But I think of Paul Claudel, another of those authors who was undoubtedly on John's bookshelves. And Claudel so beautifully said that death changes a man into himself. Death changes a man into himself. So that John has, as it were, become the person that he was always meant to be. And I think also of Chesterton again, speaking of George Bernard Shaw. Chesterton said that Shaw has a heroically large and generous heart, but not a heart in the right place. Well, John, from everything that I know, had a heroically large and generous heart, but a heart that was in the right place. And that place is, of course, in all our hearts this evening. I said that Malta was twice besieged and twice unconquered. And in a sense, John was aware that Malta now undergoes a third siege, a siege of secularism, a siege of indifference, a siege of consumerism, a siege of hostility to religion. It is a siege that Malta shares with the rest of the Western world. And it was John's great grace to lead the forces against that siege. And in our way this evening, I think we are likewise helping to lead the forces against that siege. So let me, with your indulgence, say a few words about Chesterton as a journalist. Father Ian Boyd, my colleague and friend, will say some more words about Chesterton as a journalist, and we'll look perhaps a little more closely at some of his theological notions which come through his journalism. Let me try to say something about Chesterton as a practicing journalist. G.K. Chesterton's proudest boast was that he was a journalist. In a writing career that began in his early 20s, and ended only with his death some 40 years later, he tried his hand at nearly every literary form and succeeded in all of them. Novels, detective stories, poetry, plays, biography. Yet it was as a newspaperman, a member of what he called the easiest of all professions, that Chesterton wished to be remembered and for which, during his lifetime, he was best known. I think, wrote his friend and colleague W.R. Titterton, that Chesterton, Belloc, and Cecil Chesterton, that's Chesterton's brother, that Chesterton, Belloc, and Cecil Chesterton were always prouder of being journalists than literary men. Men who are always counting their sales, or still worse, cultivating their style. Men who have no idea what is happening in or to England and don't care. The Hungarian philosopher Orel Kalnai called Chesterton a Fleet Street Aquinas, a public house phenomenologist, the description acknowledging that his natural habitat was not the library, the cloister, or the university, but the pub, the office, and the saloon. Titterton knew him as a joyous creature who blew in at the Adelphi like the herald of good news and came to rest at the bar, breathless and beaming. Fleet Street was Chesterton's world, a loud, meritocratic place where he came alive in the company of friends, colleagues, and from time to time, one or two rogues. Chesterton was a journalist because he was a Democrat, delighting that something as rude and healthy as a newspaper could make its way into the hands of shop boys and office workers and 9-to-5 men, the forgotten people of England, as he called them, that have never spoken yet. His friends were newspaper men, Charles Masterman, Hilaire Belloc, E.C. Bentley, W.R. Titterton, Edward MacDonald. He was the first editor to publish George Orwell. The papers which carried his name read like a roll call of late Victorian and Edwardian England. The Speaker, the Daily News, the Daily Herald, the Illustrated London News, Reynolds News, all enjoying large readerships and influence due in part to Chesterton's name in their pages. Eyewitness, New Witness, and GK's Weekly, his other papers, were lively, idiosyncratic, and opinionated. That is to say, they were Chestertonian. Mr. G.K. Chesterton is one of the great writers here, wrote Mahatma Gandhi in Indian Opinion in January 1910. He is an Englishman of liberal temper. Such is the perfection of his style that his writings are read by millions with great avidity. Certainly, they helped to shape Gandhi's views of Indian nationalism. Chesterton was a writer of brilliant gifts, a journalist's journalist, the prose poet of his profession. It is hard to imagine him in any other walk of life. Well, from one point of view, none of this is surprising. From another point of view, it is very strange. What is unsurprising is that journalism appealed to and made good use of Chesterton's extraordinary versatility as an essayist, commentator, humorist, and all-purpose public philosopher. There was nothing he could not write about, nor any Fleet Street vehicle in which, for at least a time, he was not prepared to ride. I wrote on a nonconformist organ like the old Daily News and told them all about French cafes and Catholic cathedrals, and they loved it because they had never heard of them before. I wrote on a robust labor organ like the old Clarion and defended medieval theology and all the things their readers had never heard of, and their readers did not mind a bit. The trick, he said, was to write an article for the Sporting Times and another for the Church Times and put them into the wrong envelopes. Knowing some priests in Ireland, I think they would much prefer the Sporting Times to the Church Times. I can't speak for Malta, of course. Although, congratulations to Valletta on the great victory 2 days ago. He never shied away from unpopularity, which is what made him so popular in the first place. He created the appetite by which his work could be understood. Chesterton's journalism thus generated a huge response from readers who thought of him not only as an authority, but also in some mysterious way as a friend. The writer Hesketh Pearson, hearing of his death in 1936, thought a hollow groan must have echoed all over England as the country awoke to the news. He was, as they say, a national treasure. Chesterton himself knew that his bond with the public went deeper than affection, and he sometimes worried about it. The last thing he wanted, he told W.R. Titterton, was to become a guru like Bernard Shaw or H.G. Wells or Aldous Huxley, interpreting the universe in terms of the little bit of truth that happened to appeal to me personally. I will not call it my philosophy. This is a famous line from Orthodoxy. I will not call it my philosophy, for I did not make it. God and humanity made it, and it made me. Yet there was a distinctively Chestertonian attitude of mind, a tone of voice, a way of looking at the world, and the public reacted to it with fascination and delight. As Julius Stapleton's superb edition of his Daily News journalism makes clear, Chesterton knew all about the touchiness of the public, its intellectual curiosity, its appetite for controversy, but above all, he understood his own immense popularity as a weekly columnist, a kind of roamer, if you will. If an editor can only make people angry enough, he said, they will write half his newspaper for him for nothing. The Chesterton column was valuable property, so valuable that Shaw, for instance, thought him seriously underpaid for his services. In fact, Chesterton knew his own worth, calculating in a purely business-like spirit what he could command from editors at the beginning of his career, and aware, when he was an editor himself, that Father Brown would keep GK's Weekly afloat when other patrons came up short. The purely financial aspects of editorship were painful to him. Nothing bored him, but business bothered him, W.R. Titterton remarked. Yet GK's Weekly, despite difficulties, did manage to survive. With a circulation of between 7,000 and 8,000, it struggled to pay the bills, but one way or another, the bills were paid. Chesterton subsidized it, which is to say the public, who would buy his stories but not his papers, subsidized it. One way or another, the spiritual kinship with readers was exceptionally close. That the famously impractical Chesterton could make his living in the rough and tumble deadline meeting world of Fleet Street is not as improbable as it seems. Chesterton may have had to telegram his wife to discover where he needed to be, a very famous story, those Chestertonians among you will know it. He may have had to telegram his wife to discover where he needed to be, but from a purely literary point of view, he was far from distracted or out of place. His powers of concentration were as great as his powers of invention. He could write almost anywhere, in the pub, in the club, even in the street, resting the paper against the wall. "I do so like to read your articles, Mr. Chesterton," said Edward Cadbury, owner of the Daily News, to him. "Tell me, what is your inspiration? And where do you write them?" "I write them on beer, Mr. Cadbury. And I write them in the little pubs of Fleet Street." These were hard words for a teetotal proprietor to hear. It was as if he could write, he could not write of human beings, it was as if he could not write of human things without some human contact. "I went to Fleet Street this morning," wrote an American visitor, "and met G.K. Chesterton face to face. Wrapped in a cloak and standing in the doorway of a pie shop, he was composing a poem, reciting it aloud as he wrote. The most striking thing was that no one took the slightest notice." So, journalism as a profession was made for Chesterton. He loved its clubbiness, its maleness, its connection with the public, its daily and weekly excitements. Yet, from another point of view, there is something strange about Chesterton as a journalist. Several strange things, in fact, which speak to the complexity and subtlety of his art. To be a journalist, after all, was to be, in some sense, morally compromised, keeping company with editors, proprietors, and the assorted hacks who made Fleet Street a byword not only for freedom, but also corruption. "You cannot hope to bribe or twist, thank God, the British journalist, but seeing what the man will do unbribed, there's no occasion to." Belloc's famous verse was a motto for Chesterton, who romanticized the profession, but also, in a sense, repudiated it. Journalists as types do not fare well in his fiction. "Do you believe in curses?" asked Smale curiously. "I don't believe in anything. I'm a journalist," answered the melancholy being, Boone of the Daily Wire. That exchange comes from The Curse of the Golden Cross, one of the later Father Brown stories, in which the hard-bitten, difficult-to-shock reporter is forced to concede the existence of spiritual realities he would ordinarily dismiss as foolishness. Or consider Edward Nutt, editor of the Daily Reformer, who appears in The Purple Wig as a study in skeptical materialism. "Our public would never stand a Romanist priest in the story," obviously a reference to Father Brown. "Our public would never stand a Romanist priest in the story," he tells one of his writers. "I've altered him to Mr. Brown, a spiritualist." At the end of the story, God shares the same fate, being reduced to circumstances. These were unhappy men, not knowing only one emotion, fear of libel actions, fear of lost advertisements, fear of misprints, fear of the sack. and Boone, a man who looked haggard in the sunshine like a scarecrow. Indifference and acedia had entered their souls. Journalism had deadened them to the wonder of the world, as it had, by contrast, brought Chesterton to a greater realization of it. After all, he too had known despair, but it was journalism, vivid, pulsing Fleet Street, that helped him recover. With Boone and Nutt, it was the other way round. The genius of journalism was that it recorded every day the strangeness of the world. Its curse was to make its practitioners unaware of it. To lose the gift of astonishment was, to Chesterton, almost to lose the gift of life itself. So if journalism's besetting sin was cynicism, its other vice was complacency. The frivolity and irresponsibility of the press, I'm quoting from Chesterton, the frivolity and irresponsibility of the press, the evil that could be done by a corrupt and unscrupulous press, were, to Chesterton, almost impossible to exaggerate. Bad journalism, he says, bad journalism directly ruins the nation. It acts on the corporate national will and sways the common national decision. It may force a decision in a few hours that will be an incurable calamity for hundreds of years. Even when not corrupt, journalists could be intellectually lazy. The very fact that we have seen a remark, this is Chesterton, the very fact that we have seen a remark made 100 times in the newspapers is normally a very good reason for considering seriously whether the opposite is not true. The popular paper has become cold and conventional and full of clichés. The curious culture of the modern suburb will believe anything it is told in the papers about the wickedness of the Pope or the martyrdom of the King of the Cannibal Islands, and in the excitement of these topics, never knows what is happening next door. The Chesterton who admired the common man and trusted the wisdom of crowds was also the Chesterton who deplored popular credulity and feared what he called standardization by a low standard. The Chesterton, confident of the essential goodness of man, was also the Chesterton who claimed that original sin was the one Christian doctrine for which there was empirical evidence. He saw the world as a moral drama, an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Fall and redemption, darkness and light, were the twin poles of his imagination, and Fleet Street supplied ample evidence of both. Consider his relationship with newspaper proprietors. Chesterton resigned from the Daily News in 1913. Disillusioned with the Liberal Party, of which the News was the leading organ, and with the social reforms of which the Cadbury family, the paper's owners, were leading advocates. And this break with the so-called cocoa press, cocoa because, of course, Cadbury's the family of cocoa, and they owned the Daily News, this break with the cocoa press was amicable but final. It is quite impossible for me to continue taking the money of a man, George Cadbury, the father of Edward Cadbury, who may think I have insulted him, he wrote to A.G. Gardner, the Daily News's editor. It is equally impossible for me to permit him or anyone else to control what I choose to write in other places. In every way, Chesterton was a natural freelance, never a company man. Leaving the Daily News, he wrote briefly for the Socialist Daily Herald, until realizing that its pacifism in 1914 could not be squared with his own desire to wage and win war against Germany and her allies. Thereafter, he devoted his energy to the New Witness, which was passionately patriotic and pro-ally, but equally opposed to what Chesterton called the jingoism of the Daily Mail. And that was a very narrow ground, even for a writer as popular as Chesterton, between the pro-patriotism and anti-jingoism. The outbreak of war coincided with a serious collapse in his health, but once recovered, the difficulty of being a non-jingoistic belligerent became plain. The Daily Herald was not for him, and the Daily News could hardly have him back even if he had wanted to return. After all, Chesterton blamed not only Prussianism for the outbreak of war, but also Quakers and pacifists of the type of old Mr. Cadbury, whom I knew and served in my youth. The Daily News under Gardiner, the Manchester Guardian under C.P. Scott, and the Nation under H.W. Massingham had all been pacifists in the years leading up to the war. And indeed, even after the war was declared, the Daily News continued to lament the departure from our traditional policy of splendid isolation that has led to the terrible conflict in which we are now engaged, so pacifist even as the war was being declared. And Chesterton had absolutely no time for such timidities. Asquith, Prime Minister Asquith and his colleagues, had failed to stand up to Germany because they feared the wrath of the Quaker millionaires who were their party's chief financial supporters. Linking the Kaiser with old Mr. Cadbury was a striking paradox, but not professionally advantageous. An attack on the cocoa barons being, as it were, the Bourneville from which no traveller returned. Contrarianism made good copy, but not even Chesterton could always tell readers what they did not want to hear or, in good conscience, do the bidding of what he called the half-educated proprietors of the yellow press. War brought out the worst in too many journalists. "Refuse to be served by an Austrian or German waiter," proclaimed the Daily Mail. "If your waiter says he is Swiss, ask to see his passport." The Daily Mail hasn't changed very much, by the way. Chesterton was not the man to refuse food, but he was the man to refuse to work for such newspapers. Even before the war, the romance of Fleet Street was wearing off, partly because Chesterton, tired and unhealthy, had moved to Beaconsfield in 1909, and partly because of growing disenchantment with a business now conducted, as he said, as quietly, as soberly, as sensibly as that of any successful moneylender or moderately fraudulent financier. Chesterton saw the passing of the old bohemian life of Fleet Street as a metaphor for the modernity he deplored. Newspapers destroyed, he said, not by the idealism of detachment, but by the materialism of machinery. A newspaper office is now exactly like any other place of business, a proprietor had boasted to him, and I agreed with a groan. Fleet Street was also endangered by illiberalism. "Unlike the press of Italy," Chesterton said, "unlike the press of Italy, the press of England is quite free," he said. That is, editors are quite free to suppress any letters they choose or black out any foreign news that does not happen to please them. And it was also, he said, endangered by greed. He had been brought up, he said, in the ordinary newspaper-reading middle class of the Victorian age, which took for granted the belief that English politics were not only free from political corruption, but almost entirely free from personal motives about money. The closer he got to politicians and proprietors, the more he knew that not to be the case. Apart from the Illustrated London News, for which he continued to contribute a weekly column that began in 1905 and ended only with his death 31 years later. Apart from that, Chesterton no longer wrote regularly for the major papers, although occasionally appearing on them. His political and economic views were deemed eccentric, although he considered them very normal and human. It was, he said, a cold and literal fact that because they were normal and human, they could not be printed in any paper other than his own. And that is how GK's Weekly came into being. With Fleet Street closing him out, the obvious solution was to become an editor and proprietor himself. Taking over New Witness in 1916, was an act of pietas towards his dead brother Cecil. Relaunching it as GK's Weekly in 1924 was an act of bravado aimed at the Daily Mail and the Daily Herald and all those other dailies co-opted by causes they could no longer criticize. Well, it was joyful but arduous work. Chesterton was a reluctant editor, according to Maisie Ward, a bad one, according to himself, and an extremely bad one, according to his sister-in-law, Ada, herself a highly controversial journalist and a wildly erratic human being. But being casual, indulgent, and sloppy was a small fault in a writer otherwise touched by genius. Besides, a good editor is not an expert at putting a paper to bed, but at keeping a paper awake. He is a man, said W.R. Titterton, who knows what is important in the news of the day and comments on it with wide knowledge, sure judgment, impregnable honesty, and limitless courage. Here you have a picture of GKC as an editor. His paper was always wide awake. As I read those comments, I think somehow they also describe John, someone who knows what is important in the news of the day and comments on it with wide knowledge, sure judgment, impregnable honesty, and limitless courage. As for proprietorship, GK's Weekly was a model of the difficulties as well as the benefits of the independent ownership it enjoined on its readers. It was amateurish in the proper sense that it was sustained by love. Father Brockard Sewell remembered with a wry sense of social comedy his time as the paper's teenage factotum. On Wednesday afternoons, I had to go to Euston Station to collect copies of the new number, which arrived by train from Nuneaton. It was my job to bring them back to the office by taxi, delivering some of the larger bundles to firms of wholesale newsagents on the way. Since all the bundles could be got into one taxi, it will be surmised that the circulation was not large. Sewell, Father Sewell, had a higher opinion of Chesterton as an editor than had Ada Chesterton, but even he acknowledged that, as a Fleet Street figure, Chesterton had entered the autumn of his years. Chesterton, he said, Chesterton we saw once a month, apart from his occasional appearances at distributist meetings in London. Distributism was Chesterton's great social philosophy of widespread independent proprietorships. If you want to know about it, ask Klaus, who is a very distinguished Maltese Chestertonian and believer in distributism. Chesterton we saw once a month, apart from his occasional appearances at distributist meetings in London. With his great size and girth, the ascent of our steep and shaky old staircase was trying for him. And we could hear him wheezing and groaning on his way up until he came through the office door and sank into the editorial swivel chair, which was just, but only just, big enough and strong enough to support him. His absentee editorship worked very well, for there was an assistant editor in charge, that was W.R. Titterton and then Edward MacDonald, who put the paper together each week and saw it through the press. Mr. Chesterton's copy always arrived in good time by post, or if he had been delayed in writing, by train. Could you imagine nowadays journalists sending their copy by train in an era of Skype and all sorts of other things, you know, waiting from the for the 5:45 from Nuneaton or Beaconsfield. The contents of each number he always discussed over the telephone with the assistant editor. Well, the quality of GK's Weekly has been much debated. Maisie Ward, Chesterton's biographer, was surprised at how much she enjoyed GK's Weekly when she gave it a second look. Brockard Sewell thought that under Titterton it had a liveliness which it never quite regained when he left. Titterton himself, who was admittedly biased as the assistant editor, thought it the best weekly review in England. Father Ian Carr, Chesterton's latest biographer, whom Peter mentioned, Father Ian Carr notices its humour. As with any paper, it varied from week to week and year to year, sometimes showing Chesterton at his best, as in the articles later collected in a book called The Outline of Sanity, and sometimes Chesterton sort of off form, when he was talking about Prussianism as an explanation for Hitler in the 1930s. Chesterton had a kind of obsession with what he called Prussianism, by which he meant scientific efficiency and crude materialism. Yet GK's Weekly was a paper that wanted, above all, to close down. It was dedicated to a cause, widespread private ownership or distributism, whose achievement would make the paper unnecessary. When it is no longer thought amusing to say that a farm should belong to a farmer, and no longer called brilliant to suggest that a human being might live in his own house, then we are needed no more. All of Chesterton's life, all of his thinking, is summed up by the paper's insistence on what Robert Louis Stevenson called the ultimate decency of things. And the most ultimately decent thing, better even than a farm or a house, was existence itself. Chesterton's philosophy of journalism was his philosophy of life. He wanted people to wake up, to make them take notice, to remind them that they are alive. As an Irish Chestertonian, Father Thomas Sheridan, put it shortly after Chesterton's death, "The defense of orthodoxy has one almost overwhelming disadvantage, that men have heard it all before." It is almost impossible to make the facts vivid because they are familiar. To overcome this fatigue of familiarity, it may be necessary to stand the facts on their head, that people may at least wonder. If you say, "All men are mortal," the audience will yawn. If you say, "All men are immortal," they may sit up and ask, "What are you driving at?" And you can tell them in that waking moment that their souls will never die. After that, they may lapse back into their former slumbers, but you will have driven one point home. Now, and I still quote Father Sheridan, now Chesterton was defending orthodoxy, and the facts were staring everyone in the face, as they had been staring him in the face for years. His task was to open their eyes that they might see. He stood the facts on their head, and people thought he was saying something new. And because they accepted everything anew, they accepted what he said and called him a master of paradox. He shuddered, but continued, "The whole position is in his own paradox. It is the obvious things that are never seen." And G.K.'s Weekly was dedicated to the obvious things that are never seen. It is surely fitting, then, that Chesterton's last great venture as a journalist should have captured the themes of a lifetime. "The issue is now clear," he said on his deathbed. "It is between light and darkness, and everyone must choose his side." That had always been the issue for Chesterton, between the nightmarish world of the man who was Thursday and the joyful, gigantic secret of orthodoxy, between the reality of the devil in magic and the reality of God in St. Thomas Aquinas. Journalism and journalists had such a draw for him because they inhabited a morally complex world. More precisely, they showed the moral complexity of the world, but also, finally, its goodness. Even when he tired of Fleet Street, Chesterton never tired of papers. Even when he was dying, he saw the point of living. A profession that showed writers at their best and their worst, owners at their best and their worst, readers at their best and their worst, was the profession for him. Chesterton was aware of the ephemerality of his calling, the fact that today's column is tomorrow's kindling, the fact that even the great end up in the great. In that sense, papers contain their own theology, being reminders of human mortality, yes, but also of the dailiness of living, the here and nowness of things, the incarnational value of the ordinary and the down-to-earth. That, for Chesterton, was their strongest appeal. "Poetry," Ezra Pound said, "is the news that stays news." But news itself, Chesterton might have countered, is a kind of poetry, an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. The gospel is good news. Chesterton wished his readers to see the familiar as if for the first time, and he chose newspapers as his vehicle. But newspapers themselves, and the men and women who wrote for them, were also two of those unfamiliar, familiar things. They, too, had to be seen as if never seen before. The poet writing his name upon a score of little pages may or may not have an intellectual right to despise the journalist, he said. But I greatly doubt whether he would not be morally the better if he saw the great lights burning on through darkness into dawn, and heard the roar of the printing wheels weaving the destinies of another day. Here, at least, is a school of labor and of some rough humility, the largest work ever published anonymously since the great Christian cathedrals. For 40 years, Chesterton played a magnificent part in the building of those here today, gone tomorrow cathedrals. Think of that and be grateful the next time you buy a paper. Thank you.
You have just listened to the first part of Chesterton as a Journalist, a conference organized by the University of Malta and Seton Hall University. This event was dedicated to the memory of John McAuliffe, alias Roma.